diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of this story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
As Afghanistan marks a year since its occupiers left the country, in particular the U.S., the country is facing many challenges. Not that it was free of them. Its economic system is in peril, yet the U.S. refuses to give back Afghanistan's government's money to the ruling government, the Taliban. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at U.S.'s disastrous Afghanistan occupation and pullout a year ago, and then see how the country can pull back from the brink. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah Magner joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from Marseille, France. Also joining us will be Frank Emspach. He's an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Thank you both for joining us in this program. Elijah Magner, I'm going to first start with you. We're looking at Afghanistan's one-year anniversary, and let me see what they have called it, the Day of Salvation and Freedom. If they have called it that, natural question, one of them would be, have they been salvaged and freed?
Thank you for having me. At least they were freed from the U.S. occupation that remained in the country for 20 years and occupied the country to liberate Afghanistan from the Taliban and, according to the Doha Agreement carried out by Donald Trump and later on by Joe Biden, gave back the power to the Afghan Taliban once again after 20 years. So what the Americans did is exactly what Julian Assange said, that the Americans were aiming for a long war, not a successful war. What the Americans have done after 20 years of occupation of the country, they basically destroyed the country and left the country with the suspension of the international aid, freezing of access to Afghanistan foreign exchange reserves, and blocking $9 billion that Joe Biden is withholding on the Afghan population in exchange of course, dictating its own conditions, of which starting with appointing a central bank director that's selected by the Americans. So because of the dire situation in Afghanistan, because of the Americans have destroyed the country and left the country really on the floor, the Afghani today can't really maintain the country and can't survive without foreign aid. Now, there is no foreign aid. It's very little arriving to Afghanistan, nothing to compare of what the Americans and the Europeans are giving to the Ukrainian in their war against Russia. So without an international support, with the security challenges, with the Americans sending drones and assassinating whoever they want, violating the Afghanistan's sovereignty, the situation in Afghanistan 1 year after the withdrawal of the U.S. occupation force is not looking very well.
Well, on this day, Frank Emspach, you have many Afghans that are of the belief that good riddance. They said death to the United States. This day is the day of the victory of truth over falsehood and the day of salvation and freedom of the Afghan nation. Many of them came out and relayed that sentiment. What brings a question that comes about here is, what was the U.S. doing in Afghanistan which saw them required them to stay in that country for 20 years and then pull out when they did?
Well, I think that part of the reason we went into Afghanistan is that we wanted to wreak revenge on the 9/11 destruction, and Afghanistan was a handy target. We weren't going to attack the people who attacked us, Saudi Arabia. All the people who were doing this were Saudis, and they were holed up in what used to be an American base in Afghanistan. So it was a clear target, and it was a chance for the United States to, what we thought, overthrow a weak government and take over. Well, it didn't work out that way. And once you get involved in this kind of thing, a country like ours, or France for that matter, in Africa, and or Indochina a generation ago, it's hard for the leadership to admit it and say, well, you know, this was not a good idea, and we'll let the Afghanistanis run their own country. So once you're involved, you have this escalating situation, at least here, who lost Afghanistan, and a fear of the government from being attacked by people who claim it's weak. I think, though, that at this stage of the game, the destruction of the country is what's first and foremost. And I think what we saw here today in this country, that is Saturday, Sunday, and today is Monday, it was extensive coverage of Afghanistan for the first time in almost a year. And what was interesting about it is that some of the coverage actually mentioned that the Taliban were trying to accomplish something, not all favorable, but mentioning that some schools had been reopening. And an interesting thing in the New York Times coverage was the focus on women in medical school there, and that that's still functioning. And so it was, for the first time, not a completely negative series of articles. Now, I was only looking at the Times, the Wall Street Journal, and National Public Radio, so I can't say what happened throughout the rest of the media. Mm-hmm. But at least some recognition that there was something going on there other than just repression. However, there was no real focus on one of the facts that the United States has basically stolen the Afghan treasury and has made things much, much more difficult. There did not seem to be an emphasis, however, on anything like the United States getting ready to try to overthrow the current government, which I thought was a good thing that that was not focused not a focus of the news.
Well, Elijah Magner, I'm trying to put things into perspective over here when it comes to the one-year anniversary and how the Taliban has, I was going to say progressed, but actually hasn't progressed much. So you're looking at a list of factors over here where they have not been recognized by the international community. You're looking at the fact that, for example, the marginalization of minorities, marginalization of women, a ban on secondary education for girls on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you have people dying from hunger. There's no work. Unemployment is skyrocketing. And it almost looks as if, not that I'm saying the woman recognition is not very important, or having what the U.S. considers a terrorist to be, I think, the central bank, holding a position in the central bank, as you mentioned. But if you put things into perspective, the country is not doing well. Shouldn't there be more focus on the humanitarian and the economic side of things, as opposed to, well, because they're not letting women come into the workforce and or things that have to do perhaps with the way that women are not given opportunities?
Well, here in the West, the focus mainly on something more exciting, talking only about women's rights and the women going to school or allowed to go to school and university, disregarding the fact that Afghanistan is really starving. According to the looking at Afghanistan from a real perspective, one should look at what are the priorities first. The priorities is not, of course, to undermine minority and to mistreat women and prevent the schooling and university, etc., but first to allow people to survive and eat and be able to stand on their feet and grow in a country that has been devastating by occupation and was not doing well even before the occupation. So what we see today, one thing positive is the drop of civilian casualties since August 2021 that went from 7,000 to 1,000. However, we see increased action of the Islamic State Khorasan that the Americans have contributed not to fight, but to transport from Syria to Afghanistan. So all these disregarding the
why would they do that?
Security. Sorry?
Why would they do that? Why would they transfer the Daesh terrorists from, I think you said, Syria to Afghanistan?
Well, because they were facing Taliban and not managing to face Taliban. So they wanted the enemy of Taliban because ISIS was in Syria the enemy of everybody, including the extremist Sunnis and Al-Qaeda. And because Al-Qaeda and Taliban are together, so ISIS Khorasan were transferred from northeast Syria into Afghanistan to fight the Taliban. And because the Americans had no real intention to withdraw and they did not have a clear idea when to leave, and we saw how Donald Trump spent several years in negotiating in Doha, and when Joe Biden came, he did not want to leave, and he was mainly forced to leave because he was not expecting Taliban to take Kabul so quickly and wanted the Afghan army to fight for at least 6 months. So this didn't happen. The Americans were taken by surprise. They were forced to abandon the embassy, abandon the city, were caught at the airport, and they had to flee the country. So all that speeded up the delivery of power to Taliban by the same Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, at that time, because he saw how the Americans abandoned him. So now the country is really under financial difficulties, and the Americans are the main factor contributing by freezing $9 billion to a poor country devastated by a war and blocking all this very vital asset to the Afghanis. This is a main contributor. And that is the priority of the Afghani government today, sure, is to feed the population and to look after what's going to happen to the infrastructure. They can't do that.
Well, I mean, you know, Frank Emspach, when you take a look at the Afghans and they're seeing this $9 billion in frozen funds not being returned, you can imagine how they feel about the U.S. after this, even the ones who perhaps had an admiration for the U.S. I'm sure that has been dented. You're looking at the $9 billion, you're looking at the halting of foreign aid that at some point constituted 80% of Afghanistan's annual budget, if you can believe that. And you said, Frank Emspach, that you thought at one point that maybe the U.S. Was contemplating coming back into Afghanistan. Well, I mean, aren't these actions by the U.S. somewhat a recipe for a country to be choked off to the point where maybe the U.S. does have the intention of perhaps coming back into the country, or at a minimum, making sure that country remains unstable?
I think the minimum making it keep unstable is an objective of some. But not all. I think we have to go back to that 80% business. No country can go with 80% of its budget being paid for by a third party from on August 1st to zero on August 18th and expect that everything's going to be okay. And I think that that's what we did. In addition to that, although, yes, we have allowed some foreign aid, the fact of the matter is all kinds of sanctions are in place. We've made it extremely difficult for other aid agencies and other countries to give money to Afghanistan. The exception seems to be the International Red Cross, who is running about 30 hospitals in Afghanistan at the moment. But the fact of the matter is, if we as Americans or all the people in Western Europe, what we used to call Western Europe, want to deal with this honestly, we have to demand that our governments pay up, support the Afghan government, not decide we're going to let people starve to death because we don't like the Taliban, and recognize that within the Taliban, as was on National Public Radio yesterday, here, you had two leading Taliban people debating each other about, how important the education of women was, high schools, and pointing out that in about a third of the country, the high schools for women are open because the people will not stand for them being closed. And so the NPR correspondent said, gee, you mean that there's all that kind of opposition? And one of the leaders said, it isn't opposition. We have a difference of opinion on that. That's perfectly valid. And a third of the country, he said, we have women in high school. He said, so, yes, we have internal divisions. Now, that, I think, when you can discuss that kind of thing openly on international news, these guys were both leaders in Afghanistan. This is a pretty good thing, it seems to me, and would suggest that if we, the United States, would get our foot off their neck and not continue to assassinate people in the middle of their capital and whatnot, right, and allow politics to grow, we're going to have a much more secular and a much more democratic system than we had there under American rule.
Right.
That should be our objective. And the only way that's going to happen, I think, is if American people or the French people say that our governments have to actually be serious in building the country and not making it difficult for the government.
I mean, you know, we could talk about just the $9 billion and form a program out of that. Because if we really think about it, if the U.S. is so concerned about where this money is going to go, why don't they start with $1 billion and see how that's going to go? Forget $1 billion, $500 million. No, seriously, looking at a country that people are dying in there after all this time, and, I mean, that country is not doing well. Iran is doing its share of having the refugees come in, you know? But let's move on to the whole Daesh al-Qaeda situation, Elijah Magnier. And I'm not trying to imply anything. I'm really curious as to how that stands. Why, if you think the Taliban could do more to eliminate them, especially coming on the heels of Ayman al-Zawahiri to have been killed by the U.S. forces, which they said they don't need a DNA to have that proven. But regardless, is the Taliban actually doing enough to eradicate it, Daesh, from the country?
Al-Qaeda is not the enemy of Taliban and vice versa. So the Taliban never had the intention to eliminate Al-Qaeda. On the contrary, they offer shelter to Al-Qaeda, but they didn't want Al-Qaeda to carry out operation or terrorist attacks against other countries starting from Afghanistan. That was the main problem between the Taliban and the Americans, because the Taliban refused to deliver Al-Qaeda leaders to the Americans. Now, when Ayman al-Zawahiri is killed in the middle of Kabul, he was offered a shelter willingly by the Taliban government, and the Americans were not very much foreign to what Al-Qaeda is doing there and to the relationship between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And also, I would like to add something else. The Americans negotiated with the Taliban for over 3 to 4 years in the Doha, in Qatar. So they were very much aware that the Taliban were taking the leadership of the country, and they will be the next ruler. So if they like it or not, if they didn't want the Taliban, they would not have negotiated with them. When Joe Biden said, I expected the army to last for at least 6 months, because he knew at the end of these 6 months, had the army held its position and fought the Taliban, will give up on the capital to the Taliban. So everybody was aware that the Taliban will take over. Taliban and Al-Qaeda are friends. The only problem is they both have one common enemy, is the ISIS, Khorasan, or the Islamic State. They don't have, they are not the enemy of the Americans. They said it today, Zabihullah Mujahid said today, we want good relationship with the Americans, and we expected the Americans to stand by their deal and the Doha agreement, which they not. So it is not a question of relationship between Al-Qaeda and Taliban. The Americans collaborated widely with Al-Qaeda in Syria. They supported them. They trained many of Al-Qaeda members under the name of jihadists that we know they are under the Al-Qaeda umbrella. So it has never been a real issue. It is just selective when the Americans want to assassinate an Al-Qaeda leader. Well, they go for that just for domestic reasons and domestic policy.
I was making perhaps a mistake of grouping all of them as a Daesh terrorists. And perhaps thank you for breaking that open or breaking that up and explaining the difference there. Amir Khan Mottaki is the acting foreign minister, Frank M. Spack. One of the statements he made on this day is, quote, we want a good relationship with all countries. And then my question to you of what he said, we won't let Afghanistan's territory be used against anyone. Who's going to be using the Afghan territory against another country, and which country or countries is he referring to, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I'm not an expert on all the different organizations that are attacking Pakistan or involved in various activities against Iran or whatever. But I think that the major point that the Afghan government is trying to make here is that they will not tolerate the use of Afghanistani territory as a launching pad for anybody against anybody. And I think that's what they're trying to accomplish. And that they may have other political organizations that are taking shelter there. That's one thing as far as they're concerned. But using Afghanistan as a launching pad is another. They're trying to exert a sovereignty and say that the Afghanis are equal, and people should recognize them as such. And I believe that you're going to see that begin to happen relatively soon. It may not happen with the United States, but we take a look at what we did in Vietnam. It was the same story. All of a sudden, we said, oh, my God, what's happening here? And the Saigon army collapsed in, 2 months, from about January to April, finished, right? And we'd been saying all along in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then instead of following through on the peace plan that we had, there were supposed to be reparations. Remember that? There was supposed to be trade and all that. Forget it for 10 years,
Right.
And so we also did the same thing there as we're doing with Afghanistan. And I think it's really unseemly and hypocritical and the wrong thing for this country to be doing. So we, the United States, can make a major contribution to stability there should we wish to do so. But it doesn't. That's the case.
Well, unless you're making instability 60 kilometers close to where China's. Final question comes to you, Elijah Magnier. Please explain to us in a short time, 1 minute, if you can, what's going on with the neighbors of Afghanistan, in particular China, Iran, and Pakistan. China is said to, another question is how China actually received the Taliban, it seems like from the get-go, when they took over. It is now said that they are not incurring tariffs on any of the imports that come, anything that goes into the country, and they've actually are somewhat cooperating the security with Afghanistan. But regionally, with the regional countries and neighbors, how do you see things going from this point on?
From the first day the Americans completed their withdrawal from Afghanistan, from Kabul, immediately Iran supplied Afghanistan with oil most needed in the country. China rushed to Afghanistan and offered its support because stability in Afghanistan is extremely important, not only for Pakistan, but also for China, even if the borders are not very large, but with Iran as well. And we see many delegations going to Tehran because the security in Afghanistan, stability in Afghanistan is extremely important to maintain the security on the borders and make sure there will not be a flood of Afghani refugees in Iran, as it's actually happening today and in the last year because of the economic situation. So the stability in Afghanistan is very important for the neighboring country and not seemingly important for the Americans who were there for 20 years and were very much aware what kind okay. of security Afghanistan is in need of.
Thank you. I'm sorry we're fresh out of time, but thank you so much. Frank Emspach, Emeritus Professor, University of Wisconsin for Madison. And thank you, Elijah Magnier, Journalist and Political Analyst from Marseille, France. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم قال رب المشرق والمغرب وما بينهما إن كنتم تعقلون
Moses said, Lord of the East and the West and that between them, if you were to reason.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing the 27th verse of chapter Shu'ara. قَالَ إِنَّ رَسُولَكُمُ الَّذِي أُرْسِلَ إِلَيْكُمْ لَمَجْنُونَ Pharaoh said, Verily, your messenger who has been sent unto you is a veritable madman. But in answer to this, Moses says, قَالَ رَبُّ الْمَشْرِقِ وَالْمَغْرِبِ وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا إِن كُنْتُمْ تَعْقِلُونَ Moses said, The Lord of the East and the West, and what is between the two, if you have the understanding. Previously, we started this part of chapter Shu'ara, in which the Almighty Allah discusses the verses about the invitation of Prophet Moses and his brother Aaron, how they invited Pharaoh to monotheism. فَأْتِيَا فِرْعَوْنَ فَقُولَا إِنَّا رَسُولُ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ The Allah orders them to go to Pharaoh. They ask him to send with them Bani Israel, the children of Israel. But in answer to that, Pharaoh says, We cherished you as a child among us. And this is not the correct answer to the mercies we have shown to you. And of course, you have killed one of us, which is very ungrateful of you. In answer to that, Moses accepts. So he says, فَعَلْتُهَا إِذَنْ وَأَنَا مِنَ الضَّالِّينَ If I did it, then I was, as you think, in error. And that is why I escaped from you, because I feared that you might get me. When he invites Pharaoh to monotheism, Pharaoh says, مَا رَبُّ الْعَالَمِينَ What is the Lord of the worlds? He describes the Lord as the one who is the owner of the heavens and the earth and what is between them. And he says that this is the Lord of you and all your fathers. But in response to that, since he has no logical answers to these arguments of Moses, he goes on to impute insanity to Moses. And he says, إِنَّ رَسُولَكُمُ الَّذِي أُرْسِلَ إِلَيْكُمْ لَمَجْنُونَ The one who is unable to answer a logical argument will resort to anything to get away from answering. And insulting, foul language, and false accusation, these are the typical ones to use. And this, imputing insanity to the prophets, has been, throughout the history, one of the most powerful tricks of these oppressors against the prophets and the messengers of the Almighty Allah. But anyway, these unfair accusations have no effect on the soul of Moses. So he continues the path of monotheism by Almighty Allah's signs in the expanse of creation, microcosm and macrocosm. He says, رَبُّ الْمَشْرِقِ وَالْمَغْرِبِ وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا إِن كُنْتُمْ تَعْقِلُونَ. The Lord of the East and the West, and what is between the two, if you have the understanding.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So this is what Moses answers Pharaoh. This Lord I'm talking about is the Lord of the East and West, and what is between the two, if you have the understanding. Now, if Pharaoh had an unreal government in a small region called Egypt, Allah's real government is the one that rules the East and the West and all that exists among these two. His signs are seen everywhere in all creatures. Basically, the very rising and downing of the sun in the East and the West, even the system that works in it, is the sign of His magnificence. But the problem is that these people do not ponder these. Even they're not used to thinking. That is why the verse says, إِن كُنْتُمْ تَعْقِلُونَ. So, we must really pay attention that the Quranic sentence, إِن كُنْتُمْ تَعْقِلُونَ, if you have understanding, refers to this fact that Pharaoh had used to thinking in the past and present. He would understand this fact. But Moses answers this insanity accusation very nicely, saying that he is not insane, and a person who does not see all these signs of Allah is the true insane and madman. We'll talk about this verse more, God willing, in the next episode. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always but for me worry, and that's when faith begins.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Austria is famous for its stunning architecture and artistic legacy, boasting to be the home of the great German composers, including Mozart and Beethoven. Sadly, however, Austria has built up another reputation in recent years, that of growing intolerance towards its Muslim minority. According to data released in June 2022, over 1,000 Islamophobic incidents were reported the previous year, a shocking increase which has grown year upon year. Research into anti-Muslim hate crimes in Austria have found that the overwhelming majority of the incidents which take place has been men targeting women, with a staggering 69% of victims being female, many of whom wear the hijab. However, it's not just on the street level where the targeted harassment of Muslims is taking place. The sharp spike of 2021 was allegedly assisted by the controversial state-implemented Islam map, introduced by authorities to highlight the location of all mosques across Austria. Critics believe it aided in the spread of hate crimes. Press TV sat down with Iman Shaker, who's experienced firsthand what it's like to be a target of hate after she was almost physically assaulted for wearing a hijab.
I don't think you can name a single visibly Muslim person in this country that hasn't been verbally attacked or even physically. And I try to not give a lot of attention to the individual attacks I face, because that would just be, that would just be very...
Although it was hard to relive the experience, Iman doesn't believe in playing the victim, instead focusing on the root cause.
Focusing on a single perpetrator and focusing my anger towards him would be very weakening, in my opinion, because in the end he has fallen victim to the narrative that the state has given him about us being a threat.
In November 2020, Austrian authorities launched Operation Luxor, which saw homes and offices of Muslim charities and activists raided as part of a so-called war on political Islam. But critics claim its only achievement is dehumanizing Muslims and fueling growing public fear towards Islam. An increase in fear almost certainly leads to more hate. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Thousands of South Korean unionists and their progressive supporters rallied in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-South Korea war games planned for later this month. The drills will be the largest in years and follow the May election of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who's promised to take a hard line with North Korea. Union leaders worry about risks.
The threat of nuclear war is growing on the Korean Peninsula. Conservative forces of Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea and those in the U.S. are frantically conducting aggressive war drills in the sky, the land and the sea, and are about to start large-scale joint military exercises aimed at the invasion of North Korea. We must stamp out this behavior of anti-reunification forces.
While many South Koreans, especially supporters of President Yoon on the right, favor close ties with the U.S., large numbers also argue the U.S. military and the country's alliance with Washington prevent the improvement of ties with North Korea and generate tension.
We not only oppose the war exercises, but we want the U.S. forces, Korea, which is actually controlling and interfering with the Korean Peninsula, to leave this land. We believe that only then will the 80 million Koreans from both North and South be able to live peacefully.
The drills will reportedly involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group with extensive field training to include amphibious maneuvers. South Korea has also been training alongside U.S. forces with recently acquired American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. In an effort to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance, military officials from Seoul and Washington will meet to discuss the deployment of U.S. strategic assets and extended deterrence, which refers to the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons in the defense of South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine activists marched through central Vienna on Friday to vent their anger following Israel's recent bombardment of Gaza. They joined thousands of other protesters worldwide who were shocked into action after the three-day Israeli offensive left over 350 Palestinians wounded, 46 dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials.
Following the recent violence against Gaza, shocking images of children suffering and dying went absolutely viral on social media. Yet despite these disturbing images doing the rounds, they haven't been routinely featured in Western mainstream media circles. In fact, it's incredibly rare for any images of Palestinian suffering to be published at all.
They are suffering every day, every single day. People got arrested, children got arrested, people got murdered. Gaza, what we saw last week in three, 4 days, got bombed. They have no electricity. They have no way to go anywhere. They are blocked from the Israeli occupation.
I need to tell my people that we are standing up for them. We are resisting from abroad. So you have to stay strong. And I'm an artist, so it is a duty for me to raise the voice for the ones who are not heard.
We need to raise our voice, and Austria cooperates with Israel. And that's what we are doing here also is that we want to make people aware of this, that Austria is cooperating with Israel.
Despite regular condemnation of Israeli aggression by human rights groups, Palestinians continue to suffer while the Western world looks on, leaving few options left for Palestinians driven to fight for their very survival. Robert Carter, Vienna.
In mid-August last year, the Taliban took control of Afghanistan and the Western-backed government collapsed. On its anniversary, the Afghan people have not forgotten what they went through during this period. Economic collapse triggered by the U.S. seizure of nearly $9 billion in Afghan assets and cuts in global aid has been one of their main struggles. Afghans lived through a harsh winter with little food. Based on a poll by Gallup Institute, nearly all Afghans rated their lives as poorly enough to be considered suffering. Meanwhile, some neighboring countries and international bodies rushed aid to the country.
We witnessed that after the Taliban takeover, people sold their children and body organs to put food on the table. I personally lost my job and have been unemployed for months. Millions of others were unable to make ends meet due to food and cash scarcity. I urge the U.S. and the international community to release frozen Afghan funds and let the flow of aid. Afghans can no longer bear the ongoing miseries.
The security situation in the meantime has been far better than in the past two decades. That's to say, people experienced less violence and conflict this year. However, the occasional attacks by the Daesh terrorist group continue to haunt the community.
Previously, our people were living with the U.S. bombardments on their territories. Under the pretext of the war against terror, the U.S. pushed terror in Afghanistan for 20 years and violated all rights of Afghans. Since the Taliban have come to power, our country has been more secure and peaceful. I hope the Taliban succeed in cracking down on Daesh terrorist group and tightening security for all.
The Taliban, on the other hand, failed to gain international recognition. Afghans and the global community have criticized the Taliban for not forming an all-inclusive government.
This week marks the one-year anniversary of the Taliban takeover. To date, the Taliban have been unable to form a government representing all walks of Afghan society and protect their rights. In Afghanistan's history, no government has been successful without securing national legitimacy and being inclusive. The Taliban should learn from the past, seek fair engagement with Afghans, and be flexible against the global community.
All things considered, international bodies and and rights groups continue to engage with the de facto Taliban to advocate for the rights of Afghans and address your needs. They also have been calling on the Taliban to open girls' school as soon as possible. 1 year into the Taliban government, Afghans are calling on the international community to help the country's economy and force the U.S. to release its frozen assets. At the same time, they say the new government should engage more in diplomacy with other countries to improve the situation in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
As Israel's systematic attacks on Gaza and Al-Quds persist, another war continues to rage on in Europe. The battle pits pro-Palestine activists pushing a global anti-Israel boycott campaign versus local authorities who back ties with Israel. Founded in 2005, Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, also known as BDS, is a Palestinian-led movement promoting economic sanctions on Israel. Due to the movement's popularity, Tel Aviv has lobbied European lawmakers to criminalize the group and its activities. France, Germany and Britain are key battlegrounds, but lesser known is the struggles of the BDS in Austria. Speaking to local members, a crackdown on BDS activism remains ongoing.
It started in 2018 when, the local city government of Vienna, they implemented city resolutions, for example, against the BDS movement, where they say all local institutions and governmental institutions are not allowed anymore to support the movement, so which means all public places, they are restricted for us. All these restrictions against the BDS movement in Austria, in Europe and worldwide, I think it's a reaction from the Zionist movement and from the Zionist lobby, because BDS is getting stronger and stronger.
The Vienna city government are currently suing a BDS Austria representative over a Facebook post showing an image plastered over an official city poster. Elsewhere, support for the BDS can get you labelled anti-Semitic due to Austria adopting the controversial IHRA definition on anti-Semitism.
European authorities are introducing new legislation which aims to stop the activities of the peaceful boycott campaign. But policing people's desires not to invest in the Israeli regime is proving a near impossible task. Speaking to representatives of the BDS here in Vienna, they say that the response is an inevitable backlash to the group's success in undermining and damaging Israel's reputation across the continent. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Turkey's Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu says he had a side talk with Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad on the sidelines of the Non-Aligned Movement Summit in October last year. The Turkish minister added he suggested a reconciliation to take a place between the Syrian government and the opposition, noting that without such a step, Syria will continue to face a crisis. Cavusoglu said that the EU and the international community would support a ceasefire in the war-torn country, and that no country would help in Syria's rebuilding process if a ceasefire is not achieved.
To prevent the division of Syria, there must be a strong administration in Syria. The will that can dominate every corner of its lands can only be achieved through unity and solidarity. We need to bring the opposition and government together for reconciliation. There will be no permanent peace otherwise.
Some believe such a revelation is a signal indicating Turkey is preparing for its cross-border military operation in northern Syria. In recent weeks, the Turkish army has been sending reinforcements to northern Syria, near the town of Tel Rifat. The town is under the control of Kurdish YPG forces, a U.S.-backed militia that Turkey considers the armed wing of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as PKK.
I think the timing of this announcement comes as Turkey is preparing for a cross-border military operation to secure the border area and push back Kurdish forces. A reconciliation between the government and the opposition will not only bring peace to Syria, but also Turkey, a country that has been directly affected by the Syrian war, from terrorist attacks to the refugee crisis.
Some analysts believe Turkey has long been serving its own agenda in Syria. For example, by supporting some opposition groups inside Syria who served Ankara's interest in securing its borders and pushing Kurdish forces back. It might be soon to say whether Ankara has changed its strategy in regards with Syria. What is clear for Turkey is that fighting or defeating the Kurdish militants cannot guarantee its security. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Gas bills in Italy will likely double in cost from October the 1st if gas prices continue to rise this way. The recent announcement by power regulator ARERA has gone utterly unnoticed, with the Italian media focusing on the electoral campaign about a month away from the September 25 national elections. A week ago, the outgoing Italian government unveiled a 17 billion euros aid package aimed at protecting families from surging energy costs and rising consumer prices. However, ARERA and some energy experts have warned that very little has been done so far to reduce energy consumption in the country.
Italy's highly critical energy situation has been downplayed by politicians and the media. On one side, there is confidence about the country achieving its target of reaching storage levels of 90%, while on the other side, the risk that Russia could altogether stop the flow of gas to Italy has been underplayed.
Gas is central to Italy's energy systems. The country even produces over 50% of its electricity from natural gas. Rome has cut its reliance on Russian gas imports to 25% from about 40% at the start of the year, a decision that has thrown the energy sector into uncertainty. Some analysts have predicted annual gas bills could reach an average of 1,800 euros next year, almost double the annual average of 950 euros recorded this year. Many Italians are simply bewildered about how they can find themselves in a position of not being able to heat or light their homes.
It's been this way forever. I used to be a unionist. I saw the crisis coming. This is how our country works. We don't have any sovereignty.
Nothing works in this country. We have forever been in the hands of a bunch of swindlers and criminals. Italy has no future.
The outgoing government is planning to offset its dependence on Russian gas by signing new deals with African and Eastern Mediterranean countries and building new regasification plants in a number of Italian sea towns, a move that has met with staunch opposition from local residents. Max Civili, Rome.
Rights groups have accused the Israeli regime of committing war crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip during its three-day onslaught against the territory. On Friday, Israeli forces started launching wanton attacks on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of civilians, including women and children. The fighting stopped on Sunday through an Egypt-mediated ceasefire, but Palestinians now have to live with the devastating aftermath of Israeli attacks. According to Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians were systematic and deliberate and fall under Israel's strategy of using disproportionate and excessive force against civilians.
Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights reiterates its strongest condemnation of Israel's gross and systematic violations of international law, particularly in cases of extrajudicial killings and attacks against civilians and civilian objects. Such violations amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity for which those responsible must be held accountable.
Five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008. The regime has been using U.S.-made warplanes and weapons to hit targets in the densely populated area.
The United States and Israel are both responsible for the bloodshed in Gaza. Israel was given the green light from the United States to carry out the brutal attacks on Gaza under the watchful eye of the international community. Israel and the United States are partners in crime against the Palestinian people.
Human rights organizations say, based on the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, it is more than clear that Israel has been committing war crimes during its attacks on Gaza.
The impunity Israel continues to enjoy and the absence of accountability encourage Israeli officials to continue perpetuating war crimes against Palestinians. As evidenced by its latest aggression on Gaza, Israel does not hesitate to engage in prohibited acts of killing, including direct targeting of civilians. The International Criminal Court must at least investigate these crimes.
For decades now, there has been no pressure on Israel to stop its violence against civilians. Despite repeated and desperate pleas from human rights groups, the international community has stayed silent about the regime's atrocities against Palestinians.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinians continue to suffer due to international apathy. Now, rights groups are demanding that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is a program wherein we provide you with necessary information to be able to provide necessary grounds for your children to flourish and to attain perfection, which is the ultimate goal of Islam. Well, today in our studio we have with us Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad is a researcher in the Hafza Ilmi of Qom, who will be providing us answers on the basis of Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much. Jazakallah.
Well, brother, today's session I'd like to start with a parent question, which reads like, what can I do with my teenagers who do things that are completely new, sometimes weird things like making new hairstyles or dressing in a particular way, or going out at a particular time, or very opinionated? Now, since we heard the question, how do we deal with this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is very common, as the last word of the question was very precise. A teenager who's very opinionated, very often you find that. Teenagers come with their own opinions, and they want to do things very differently. And
true.
Very often, mothers and fathers are very shocked or don't understand, can't comprehend.
What's going on?
Exactly, what's going on? What is this new thing that's coming in our lives? And how to deal with it? That's a very important question. Let me suggest a traffic light system. So traffic light, I mean, you all know what traffic light is. You have red, orange, and green. And so based on this traffic light system, you deal with this new opinion that's come in the house from this teenager in a particular way. So the green light and the traffic light is for things that are very new, the opinions that a teenager will come with, but they're not necessarily bad thing.
Okay. Right?
So for example, they're a new type of, I don't know, a clothing that has a new color. I mean, who would have thought? I'm talking 20 years ago, 30 years ago, who would have thought that it was very normal for men to wear pink shirts?
Okay. Right?
Today, people are probably laughing at me like, why do you find this weird?
Are you a girl? You're looking.
No, they would find it very weird for me to ask this question. But in my generation and before that, and I'm not that old, wearing pink for a man was very, it was absolutely weird.
Okay.
Yeah. But today's world is very normal to do this. But at the same time, if you look at it, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just a different color, I guess, right?
Mm.
Or for example, your teenager eating a particular type of food, which is not necessarily haram, not necessarily harmful, just different, right?
Okay.
I remember some parents were claiming that my child come back and wants to eat sushi. Okay. I've never had sushi in my life, I guess. But there's nothing wrong with having sushi. I guess it's a different type of food.
Okay.
From a different culture, and it's fine. So this you deal with it with the green traffic light, and you say that I'll support and I'll strengthen, actually. I mean, there's no issue with it,
mm-hmm.
Even though it's very new, very